DW, World in Progress. With Anca Rasper.
In this edition, Istanbul's mega projects in the making, and not everyone's happy.
When we talk about costs, we also have to mention the price paid by the environment and nature. The new airport, the third bridge, and the highway have cut a devastating gash in nature and Istanbul's natural resources.
And the freedom of two wheels and a powerful engine. Women bikers in India.
More and more women take up motorcycling because motorcycling does give you the sense of freedom and you break glass barriers on the way while you're riding a motorcycle.
So stay tuned. Welcome to the show in Bonn, Germany. I'm Anke Rasper. The area northwest of Istanbul in Turkey has been a gigantic construction site for years, with a number of huge infrastructure projects in different stages of completion. The world's largest airport, a massive 8-lane bridge for cars and rail, a new highway and a man-made canal parallel to the Bosporus, linking the Black Sea and the Sea of Marmara. Planning for the new shipping canal is still in the early stages, but the bridge and highway are already in place. And while delayed, the airport was inaugurated at the end of October 2018, but it won't be fully open for business until March this year. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants Istanbul to become an international logistics hub, but the developments also met with criticism. Environmentalists and city planners have warned that Istanbul's last major green space could soon be gone for good. Kathleen Schuster presents this report by Christian Buttgereit.
The Belgrade Forest, north of Istanbul, got its name from the Serbian prisoners of war who were brought here after the siege of Belgrade in 1521. Today, people like to come to this expansive urban forest. It's Istanbul's last urban recreation area on the European side of the teeming metropolis. On weekends, it's impossible to find a free spot in the forest parking lots. Dense plumes of smoke hang over the picnic areas where families are grilling up food all day long. A bit further away, joggers, walkers, and cyclists enjoy the fresher forest air. The Belgrade Forest used to be even bigger. But over time, skyscrapers have nibbled away at its edges, especially over the last 30 to 40 years. Mucella Yapucu, chair of the Istanbul Chamber of Architects, says the city's latest master plan from 2009 stipulated that its ecological reserves should remain untouched.
The second bridge was a particular threat to the wetlands and drinking water reservoirs north of the city. The resulting environmental damage was so great that politicians swore they wouldn't plan any expansion further to the north. One of these politicians was Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Even if the project is expensive, the most modern way to cross the Bosporus is to build two tunnels, one for the metro and one for cars, which could hold the capacity of five bridges. A third Bosporus bridge would destroy Istanbul's remaining green lung. That would be a serious mistake.
That was President Recep Tayyip Erdogan speaking in 1994 when he was the mayor of Istanbul. Today, tunnels for the metro and for cars have been dug and are in daily use. But Erdogan's serious mistake has also become a reality. As prime minister back in 2013, he laid the foundation stone for the third Bosporus Bridge to the north of the city at the mouth of the Black Sea.
Artık İstanbul'umuzun içerisinde ağır vasıtalar görmeyeceğiz.
From now on, we will not be seeing any more trucks in the center of Istanbul. These heavy vehicles will have to cross over here, over the third bridge. After building two Bosporus bridges, we are now giving this magnificent city another, a third pearl necklace.
It's a bridge of superlatives. Its pillars are the highest in the world at 322 meters. There are four lanes of traffic in each direction with space for railway tracks in the middle. But there was a problem. To reach the new bridge, a new highway had to be built. With a nod to the forests in the north of the city, Erdogan said the new road would be an eco-highway, partially built on stilts. But despite his lofty ambitions, conservationists said around 1.6 million trees were cut down during the highway's construction. The 3.2 billion euro project was financed as a public-private partnership with an international private consortium building and now operating the bridge. By 2026, 10 years after the bridge's opening, the bridge will revert to the Turkish state. But until then, the private operator will be able to collect the toll revenue. Such a financing plan is common for major construction projects in Turkey. But Mustafa Sunmez, a renowned business journalist, describes the bridge as a double burden for the Turkish taxpayer.
The state acts as a guarantor for companies that finance these projects with loans from abroad. When these companies become insolvent, the public purse jumps in to bail them out. That's the first burden. Second, the state gives operators a guarantee on how many people will use the bridge, the tunnel, or the hospital they've built. If those numbers aren't met, the state treasury makes up the difference. Another heavy burden for the taxpayers.
Both scenarios described by Sunmez have come to pass. One of the companies responsible for operating the bridge recently filed for bankruptcy, and the number of cars using the new bridge every day is far less than the anticipated 125,000 vehicles. According to Sunmez, 6.5 billion Turkish lira, or about 1 billion euros, were set aside in last year's state budget to cover the losses of public-private partnership projects, and that was only for 2018. Taxpayers have been forced to shoulder all the risk. For architect Mujalla Yapucu, the financial losses explain why the new airport was built in the city's north.
Why? Well, because customers are needed for the third bridge. When Atatürk Airport closes and when Sabiha Gökçen Airport reduces its operations, as is expected, then we'll depend on the new airport and use the third bridge to get there and pay the toll.
Crossing the new bridge isn't cheap. Every car has to pay 13 lira, or about 2 euros, which goes directly into the coffers of the private operator. But it's not just the money, says Sunmez.
When we talk about costs, we also have to mention the price paid by the environment and nature. The new airport, the third bridge, and the highway have cut a devastating gash in nature and Istanbul's natural resources. The north has already suffered massive ecological destruction, despite all warnings. And if the new canal is actually built, the scale of environmental degradation would increase immensely.
Just a few decades ago, Istanbul's forests accounted for about two-thirds of the city's area, while the developed area was just one-third. Today, that ratio has flipped. A citizens' initiative, which developed out of the Gezi Park protests in 2013, is trying to save the northern forests, and there's still a lot to save.
There are still around 50 different species of mammals living in the northern forests, despite the proximity of the metropolis and the advances made by industry. Otters, for example, we thought they had disappeared from the region long ago, but they were recently spotted again. There are also some deer, though I don't want to say where exactly, so hunters don't get any ideas. Unfortunately, there aren't many deer left. But there are still many foxes and wolves.
Members of the Save the Northern Forest initiative are cautious. At their demonstrations, they disguise their identities by wearing squirrel masks. We meet up in a park somewhere in Istanbul. They'd rather not give their names. Many are employed by the state, one as a city planner. It's vital that the northern forests survive, they say, not only for animals and plants, but also for the people of Istanbul.
The northern forests filter the air, and by way of the prevailing north winds, they send that clean air to the Istanbul and the Marmara region. Istanbul still has relatively clean air, and that's thanks to the northern forests and the natural corridors through which this air can flow into the city. The northern forests also form an ecosystem from which spring all the sources of water, above ground and below ground, that supply the Thrace and Marmara regions. The northern forests aren't just a collection of trees and plants.
The northern forests stretch across a vast area of five provinces. But many of the trees on the outskirts of Istanbul had to give way for progress. Residents of the forest villages were kicked out, with the state buying their land for ridiculous sums. All this just so Istanbul could continue to grow.
The meeting point of the world. Istanbul New Airport is opening soon. Istanbul New Airport. Established on an area of 76.5 million square meters.
The meeting point of the world. That's the promise made by an ad for Istanbul's third airport. And once again, superlatives. It's as big as 1,100 football fields with space for 500 planes and six runways. There will be 3,000 takeoffs per day, and the number of passengers will start at 90 million and increase to 200 million. If everything goes according to plan, it's expected to be the world's largest airport by 2028. And the price? A good 10 billion euros. Kadri Samsunlu is managing director of the airport operator IGA. He says the price isn't out of proportion to the project.
The Atatürk Airport, which is located in the European side of the city, is very constrained in terms of capacity on the runway as well as on the terminal. And the flagship carrier of Turkey, Turkish Airlines, has very aggressive growth program, and the infrastructure is not able to keep up with it. Therefore, the government, as a part of the liberalization efforts in the country in the last 15 years, conducted a tender for a brand new airport with significant room for growth. And now that's why we are going to have a new airport with new facility, new runways, a new terminal. So it will be able to service the flagship carrier as well as all the international carriers who want to get a slot in Turkey to increase their frequencies.
It's not just Atatürk that's bursting at the seams. The Sabiha Gökçen Airport, which is in the Asian part of the city, has also reached its limit, which is why business journalist Mustafa Sönmez doesn't question the need for a new airport in Istanbul.
Of course, they could have expanded the existing airports, Atatürk and Sabiha Gökçen. Or another suggestion was for a new airport at the edge of southwest Istanbul. But Mr. Erdogan insisted on building here, and he wanted something bigger and more imposing. I spoke with a representative from a British company that consulted Erdogan on the selection process. He told me that they had suggested other locations, but Erdogan was explicit about building it in the northern part of the city.
It might be a fatal mistake. Regardless, it's an encroachment at the environment's expense. Even though the airport was built on land that used to be exploited for brown coal, 2.5 million trees had to be cut down and 70 lakes pumped dry. Architect Mujalla Yapucu is worried that the land is still unsafe to build on.
The area is full of gigantic holes that are filled with groundwater and rain. They filled the holes and poured a layer of concrete 2.5 meters thick for the airport's construction. But the concrete keeps sinking. The amount of work needed to fix the problem is immense.
And apparently, not always successfully. A few months ago, a hole that was about 10 meters across and 5 meters deep suddenly opened up on one of the runways. Photos of it circulated online before the crater was filled and sealed off. It's not the only problem at this major construction site. Another one is time. The airport was supposed to be opened on October 29th, the 95th anniversary of the founding of the Republic. The pressure to finish on time was enormous. Erkan is one of the roughly 35,000 builders working at the construction site. He describes what he and his coworkers have been told by their bosses.
Çabuk yapın. Burayı bugün bitireceksiniz.
They told us, work fast, it has to be done today. You have to do it. That's the job. There's the door. You can just leave if you don't want to do it. There are millions of unemployed people waiting out there. We don't need you.
Sana kalmadık.
Time is money. Yusuf Akçayolu, who was the managing director of IGA until recently,
en büyük challenge bu süredir.
Our biggest challenge is time. The earlier we finish, the more likely we are to earn money from the project.
The rush to finish construction has already claimed lives. According to the Turkish paper Cumhuriyet, there have been about 400 construction-related deaths since the work began. Kadri Samsulu, the new managing director of IGA, has heard the accusations. But he puts the number of deaths at 26, many of which, he says, had nothing to do with the work.
Well, half of them were natural death, and there has been some accident, car accidents in the, on the construction site, as a result of which around 12 people passed away. Another 14 people were just natural death.
The number of fatalities might actually be higher, according to Özgür Karabulut from the construction union Devrimci Yapı İş. Karabulut says that 35 of his workers have died since the middle of September, and he's certain that all of their deaths could have been prevented.
These construction workers would still be alive today if the necessary protective measures had been taken. The reasons are, for one, the pressure to deliver. Subcontractors want to save money by using as few workers as possible for the greatest possible output. Another reason has to do with how subcontractors work. These companies see worker safety as a money issue, and therefore choose safety measures for appearance's sake, like offering the bare minimum for safety training.
Thousands of these workers come from other parts of Turkey or from abroad. They live in simple trailers in the area and are picked up by a bus for work. Back in September, rainfall set in, adding to the unsafe conditions, and many of the construction workers finally had had enough. The workers began to protest. Karabulut says it was only a matter of time before things boiled over.
The protests materialized because there were long lines and long wait times for the commuter buses. At least that was the tipping point. Our union has brought up the terrible working conditions for at least the past 3 years. The accommodation, food, and cafeteria, the conditions are bad all around. Rage and frustration about these things have been there all along.
Security forces arrived quickly. They used tear gas and water cannons on the protesters. More than 500 workers were detained, according to the union. 160 were set free the same day, and by that evening, there was a rally for solidarity in central Istanbul. There, 20 more people were detained and arrest warrants were issued for 24 construction workers. The contractor did end up promising to do something about the slow buses, old food and bed bugs. But Karabulut says that one thing in particular changed.
Right now it feels like there are as many police officers at the construction site as workers. They're accompanied to the construction site by police and under the shadow of a water cannon, like in a concentration camp.
Shortly after this interview, Karabulut was arrested while protesting against the working conditions at the airport. He was arrested, among other things, for coercion, damaging property, and participating in a protest with weapons or objects that could be used as weapons. He could face up to 10 years in prison. The airport officially opened on October 29th, but at the moment, it's only offering flights to a few destinations, including Baku in Azerbaijan and Erjan in northern Cyprus. Before the official opening in October, Turkey's aviation authority, DHMI, admitted that the complete move of Atatürk Airport's operations to the new airport would be delayed for 2 months. That's now been delayed a second time and won't happen until March at the earliest. The reason? While the airport itself is basically finished, they still need to play out and coordinate the complicated process of arrivals and departures. And aviation experts say it's still ambitious to get all that done within the time scheduled. Architect Mujala Yapucu isn't optimistic that things will go smoothly.
I'm one of the people who is sure that this airport won't be operational. Maybe for a short period of time, for a few flights. But they won't be able to operate the airport in the long run. If they do, then I'll eat my diploma.
If the airport's destiny is anything like other prestigious projects in Turkey, that is, according to what President Erdogan wants, then the airport will have to be a success. Sooner or later.
And this report by Christian Butgereit was presented by Kathleen Schuster. We're kind of staying with the topic of transportation in our next report as well, though on a very different scale, when we catch up with a group of female motorbikers in New Delhi after this short music. Motorcycling has long been popular in India, and many use scooters or motorbikes to commute. But it's still unusual for women to ride big motorbikes, though their numbers are increasing. Bikini, an all-women motorcycling group that started in 2011, now has chapters all across the country, and more than 1,000 members from teenagers to ladies in their 50s. They come from all walks of life and share the joy of speed and independence. Sudeshna Chaudhary met some of them on a morning outing in New Delhi.
It is 6:30 a.m. on a Sunday in Delhi. It is still a bit breezy, but soon the sun will be up. At a toll booth for an 8-lane expressway into Noida, I'm waiting for members of Bikini, India's all-women motorcycle group. It is a popular meeting place for bikers, and the Bikini riders arrive all geared up in leather jackets, knee guards, gloves and helmets, in their Harleys, UM Renegade Classic, Pulsar, Kawasaki and Avengers. Some are wearing t-shirts imprinted with the name Bikini. There are 11 bikers today, and Bindu will be taking me along on her Harley. She hands me a big black helmet. The bikers take cue from each other, following each other on the road. It is fun to ride with Bindu, who is a skilled rider. It will get hot very soon, but there's a gentle breeze on our face, which makes for a pleasant journey.
And knee guard. So you'll be like, and most importantly, gloves.
After a 75-kilometer ride, we arrive at a breakfast joint at Jewar, where a lot of customers seem to be quite surprised to see a dozen women get off their motorbikes. Jyoti Mehta is a member of the Bikini Delhi chapter, and she is a wing commander in the Indian Air Force.
The Bikini group was founded by Urvashi Patole in Pune about 12 years back. Now we have about 16 chapters in various cities all over India. It's an all India first and only all women group, which seeks to basically empower women through the medium of motorcycling. Motorcycling is a sport which has been typically associated with men. The endeavor has been to encourage more and more women to take up motorcycling as a means of transportation, because motorcycling does seek to give you the sense of freedom, and you break glass barriers on the way while you're riding a motorcycle.
Jyoti has been riding motorbikes for more than 20 years. When she started, there weren't too many other female riders, she says.
Being a regular biker, when biking for women was considered to be a novelty, I have started riding because I liked the speed, the freedom, and the sense of innate empowerment and independence which you get when you ride a motorcycle.
The women say that the group has been a great platform to meet like-minded people. More than anything else, it is the camaraderie that is so palpable among the bikers that now have women joining in from all walks of life. They're police women, homemakers, beauticians, businesswomen, women working for multinational companies, jewelry designers, and several other professions. This is Bindu Chaudhary, a Harley enthusiast.
I think this was much needed. Hey, we all women can get together just to ride, feel liberated, give each other the respect and space which is much needed, but be united at the same time.
For many women, their family support has encouraged them immensely.
My family supports me 110%, and my husband taught me to ride bikes. When I go for rides with my family, my father-in-law and my mother-in-law look after the kid, so yes, I get to decide how I want to live.
My parents have always considered it to be a very normal thing for a daughter of the house also to be riding a motorcycle along with the son of house. Same thing with my husband and my child, they consider it a very normal thing that the mother rides.
But many of the bikers here had to overcome a lot of resistance from their families, like Honey Jain, a jewelry designer.
I have had no support from my family.
When I bought the bike, I just told them that I have bought my bike. That's it. After 6 months, I told them that I bought 2 bikes and that I am riding them now.
And what was the reaction?
They said,
why? Where? Didn't you ask anyone?
And I said, I don't need to ask you. It's my money and I can spend wherever I want.
And who taught you to ride bikes, first of all?
My boyfriend.
The women say that people's reactions to seeing a woman riding a motorcycle vary widely.
We just hopped by a restaurant. There were like 200 people there. So the entire restaurant was looking at us. They were thinking that these are 2 male riders, but when I took off my helmet, so it was like a female riding and they are riding separately, because otherwise it happens that a male and a female are riding together. Female is on a pillion. But when they saw that a female is riding herself, so it was like a totally different aura for me. So I can't forget that moment. It's there fresh in my mind. That keeps you going.
Shabnam Akram, who played a key role in starting the Delhi chapter of Bikini, has been riding since 1991. She has always liked the sense of independence the motorbike gives her, and this way she also avoids the many forms of sexual harassment women often face on public transport.
Basically, I was standing on a bus stop and I was teased by somebody. And that was the day I said enough is enough and I would not be using public transport. More in terms of not being dependent on somebody else for my transport. So that's the day I decided no more public transport. Since the only thing we could afford was a motorcycle, I decided to ride the motorcycle. The person most supportive of this was my husband, and he was the one who taught me to ride it well. And that's been the beginning of a very wonderful journey of riding, because once I started riding for a commute, I became a rider more in the sense of really enjoying what I was doing.
She says that most of the time the response from male bikers has been encouraging.
It's interesting that across the country, I've seen that men have been very supportive of riding. I have not really faced much of a challenge on this. It's whatever you're challenging yourself with, and you have to get over what's between your ears rather than what's outside of you. Mostly, it's not a challenge. Sometimes there are a few men who get sort of challenged and think, oh, this woman overtook me. But that's rare and happens only in certain areas. But other than that, most men do not feel challenged and they feel really happy to see. And they're just happy. Yeah, woman riding.
Shabnam, who rides solo as well as with her husband, has gone on for long journeys, mainly around the Himalayan belt. And it is women like her who have inspired many other bikers across the country.
We are over 1,000 riders across the country, linked to each other, riding. Doing great stuff is being done on the bikes. A lot of these young girls have done amazing work. They've ridden all the way from one end to the other, south to north and back, from east across to the western tip and back. They've done amazing journeys. They've done it alone. They've done it in groups. They're riding and becoming more vocal, becoming more visible, which is great. And once other people see that how simple and how normal it is for a girl to ride, more women are willing to join in.
20-year-old Manisha has just returned from a record-breaking trip to the Spiti Valley in the Himalayan mountains, where she rode through difficult terrains including river crossings and boulders on her Adventure 220.
The record which I created is being the youngest female biker who have covered the roads of Lahore and Spiti. It is around a 2,000 kilometer ride and it took me 11 days. And yeah, I faced a little bit of mishappening also. Actually, I fall 15 times at water crossings, at different roads and all. Just because of I have a little short height. But that's the spirit that if you fall, get up, get on your bike and go ahead.
And that report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. For more World in Progress episodes, go to dw.com/worldinprogress or find us on iTunes, SoundCloud or Spotify. We're back next week. Until then, all the best from us in the studio here in Bonn, Germany. That's Eliane Giarducci, Leon Novak and me, Anke Rasper. Take care.